Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast is adapted from my YouTube channel, and this episode is part of my Vault series, where I'm turning my back catalogue into podcasts. So, if I ever reference photos or things on screen, please remember that these episodes were originally made for video. Also, if research or references seem out of date, please bear in mind as well that some of these episodes were recorded as far back as 2016. I just want to make sure that all of my content is available on podcast as well for you to enjoy. If you wish to find me on YouTube, I am just Georgia Marie over there, and with all my disclaimers out of the way, enjoy the episode. Today we're going to be heading over to Australia. Now I don't know if there's been renewed interest or something in this case on the other side of the world in the past couple of weeks, but I've suddenly had a huge influx of requests that I talk about Mr. Krull. Now I will warn you that this is not a video for the faint-hearted. Mr. Krull is the name given to one of Australia's most notorious, still unidentified criminals who would break into homes and kidnap children, young girls. Whilst I am obviously going to talk about this case and cover as many important aspects as I can, there are certain elements of the story that I'm not going to give details on, both for my own sake and for yours. There are certain things that are just better left unsaid or undetailed. There's a lot of true crime that I can hack, but this type of horrific crime against children isn't one of them. But if you do wish to find more detailed information on these crimes, then I would highly recommend the Case File podcast, who are just unmatched when it comes to the reporting of true crime, or you can just give it a Google. All of my sources, as always, will be linked down below. Mr. Krull was a masked assailant who preyed on children throughout the 1980s and 1990s. To this day, he has never been caught. He would break into homes armed with a knife and a handgun, wearing a balaclava that concealed his entire face. He was incredibly careful about how he committed his crimes, and his victims were never able to provide descriptive details of this man. Therefore, the only image that Australia and the world knows of Mr. Krull is the one police sketch they have, an entire face obscured by a black balaclava, with the eyes and mouth rimmed in white stitching. You can only see his pupils and a tiny slit of a mouth. It's believed that Mr. Krull may have been responsible for around a dozen attacks in the northeast suburbs of Melbourne throughout the years, but there are only four crimes that have been officially linked to him, and therefore they will be the four crimes that we focus on today. We will also be talking in depth about the police operation that has still failed to unmask him, and the possible theories both the police and the public are working on today. More than 30 years after his last known attack, the Australian police are still determined to catch Mr. Krull. It's only a matter of time, they say, or at least they hope. The idea of a man this awful still walking around the streets freely makes my skin crawl. The first crime happened on the 22nd of August 1987, in an attack now just known as the Lower Plenty Attack. In the suburb of Lower Plenty, Melbourne, Victoria, a man broke into a family home, armed with a knife and a gun. The family and young girl involved in this attack have never been publicly identified. It was 4 a.m. when a masked Mr. Krull snuck up to the house in question and quietly removed a pane of glass from the lounge window. He crept into the house and into the master bedroom, forcing the parents asleep in there onto their stomachs with a handgun and a large hunting knife. He tied their hands and feet together and gagged them with surgical tape before forcing them into the wardrobe and locking them in, ordering them to make no sound. The knot he used was a type of knot commonly used by sailors. He told them not to worry and to remain calm. He was only interested in money. But then he makes his way into the children's bedroom, where a 6-year-old boy and an 11-year-old girl slept. He blindfolded, gagged and bound the boy, just as he had done with the parents. And then he focuses his attention on the girl. He assaults and rapes her. Once the assault was over, he doesn't rush to leave the home. He wanders around the house, he rummages through the kitchen cupboards and makes himself something to eat. He then just walks out, leaving the family helpless and terrified, wondering if this was a trap. When they finally escape their binds, they find that the assailant has cut the phone lines and they were unable to call for help. And when the police did eventually arrive, it was found that the only things the perpetrator had taken from the home were vinyl records and an old blue coat. It was obvious to them that rape was the motive here. He'd made a half-assed effort to try and make it look like a burglary, almost as if he just intended to confuse the investigators. Investigators at first looked at people close to the family for suspects, but it was clear that there was nobody who would want to do them any harm. It appeared just to be an unprovoked, random attack, and that made it all the much scarier. When the daughter was questioned, she said that in the middle of the attack, he stopped to use what she thought to be the family phone to call someone else. She said that the man had demanded that the person on the other end of the phone move their children or else they would be next. He called this person on the phone a bozo. But when the police later checked the phone records, they were baffled to find that no such call had ever taken place. And this was obviously a world before mobile phones. It just made no sense. But as the investigation continued and more attacks took place, it became clear that Mr. Krull loved to throw a red herring or two to throw the investigation off. Eventually, this goes cold. They had no idea who had attacked this girl, and it seemed to be a lone assault. At least until the 27th of December 1988, almost a year and a half later. In Ringwood, another Melbourne suburb, a man breaks into the back door of a house at 5:40 a.m. This was the home of the Wills family, a two-parent family with four daughters. John, the dad, is woken early in the morning by a masked intruder wearing dark blue overalls and a dark blue ski mask. The intruder is holding a gun to his head whilst holding a knife in the other hand, and he says, "You're not going to be a hero, are you?" As with the attack a year and a half earlier, both John and his wife are ordered to roll onto their stomachs and are bound at the wrists and the ankles, this time with copper wire. The same sailor type knot is used as before. They were then blindfolded and gagged with surgical tape, and the intruder assures them that he is only there for money. He steals $35 from the bedside table before he cuts the house's phone lines. He then heads to the bedroom that the four daughters shared. He walks directly to the bed of 10-year-old Sharon Wills and wakes her up by saying her name gently. This was a planned attack. He knew which child Sharon was, he knew her name. He blindfolded and gagged her, picking up a few items of her clothing, and then abducted her from her bed. 15 minutes later, the parents managed to break free of their ties and realised that Sharon had been taken. Of course, Mr. Krull had cut the phone lines, just as he'd done in the previous attack, so John had to run to a neighbour's house to use their phone. He desperately searched the local neighbourhood, but to no avail. Sharon was gone. But then, 18 hours later, just after midnight, she reappeared. She was found 6 kilometres away near Bayswater High School, alone and shocked, but in surprisingly strong spirits. She was wearing nothing but an old man's t-shirt and green bin bags when she walked up to a woman and said, "My name is Sharon Wills and I was taken from home early this morning. A man left me here and told me to go and ring home." The woman immediately called the police, having heard of Sharon's abduction on the local news. And she was soon reunited with her family after a horrific 18-hour ordeal. As I said at the beginning of this video, I'm not going to go into gratuitous detail of what Sharon went through. We don't need to hear it. But she was taken to a house, and during the 18-hour stretch she was abducted, she was kept entirely in the dark. Her blindfold was not removed once. She described what she could to the police, that he was a fairly soft-spoken man, and seemed to show some level of care towards Sharon. He wasn't completely brutal, despite what he put her through, as she even used the words gentle and kind to describe him. He fed her and made sure that she had enough to drink, and before letting her go, he cleaned her thoroughly. He took her into a bathroom and cleaned off any potential forensic evidence, telling her, "You're going to have to shower. You have to wash yourself really good." He clipped her fingernails and toenails as short as they could go and brushed and flossed her teeth. He didn't return her clothes to her, dressing her in the bin bags that she was found in. Investigators almost immediately made the connection to the attack that had happened in Lower Plenty the year before, and they became aware that they had a potential serial offender on their hands. This man was likely to attack again. He was dubbed around this time the Hampton Rapist. The nickname of Mr. Krull wouldn't come along for many more years. Police also realised that both girls had been featured in the local newspaper in recent weeks for different achievements, and that was likely how Mr. Krull was choosing his victims, getting fixated on these certain young girls he saw in the newspaper. It was probably how he had known Sharon's name. He broke into her house not just knowing that a young girl lived there, but he also knew intimate details about her. Everything was planned. And of course, the community begins to worry, parents keeping their children close, but it was a difficult one. This wasn't a case of girls being abducted and assaulted whilst they were wandering the streets alone. Mr. Krull was breaking into houses in the dead of night. How were the parents supposed to prevent that? Your home is where you should feel safest. But as the months went by and nothing more happened, it seemed that Mr. Krull wasn't going to attack again. Thoughts of the Hampden rapist just faded into the background. Until the 3rd of July 1990, over 18 months later once again, when this time he targeted a home in the suburb of Canterbury on Monmouth Avenue. It was the home of the Lioness family, who are actually from England. Brian and Rosemary and their two daughters, 15-year-old Fiona and 13-year-old Nicola. The family had moved to Australia 4 years earlier for Brian's job, but his contract was now over and they were due to be moving back to England in just a few days' time. That night, Brian and Rosemary went out for a final dinner with some friends, leaving Fiona and Nicola home alone for the night. They were teenagers and more than responsible enough to be left home alone. Only it seems that somebody else knew all too well that they were home alone. It was close to midnight when Mr. Krull broke in with his usual knife and handgun. The two girls were sleeping and he woke them up, giving them instructions. Fiona was tied up and restrained first, and she was told that if her father ever wanted to see Nicola alive again, he had to pay a ransom of $25,000. Another red herring, of course. There was never any intention of a ransom needing to be paid. And then his attention turns to Nicola. He takes her out of the room and orders her to pick up her school uniform. She attended the nearby Presbyterian Ladies' College. And then he abducts her, gagged and blindfolded, escaping in a car from the driveway. Sources differed as to whether it was Mr. Krull's own rental car or the family's spare car, but regardless, it seems he ditched it about a mile down the road and then transferred both himself and Nicola to his own car that he had stashed away. 30 minutes later, Nicola's parents arrive home and find Fiona tied up. She tells them that Nicola has been taken and about the ransom demand, and they call the police immediately, who soon make the connection to the abduction of Sharon all those months earlier. Over the next 2 days, they sit and wait for details of this ransom demand to come through, but nothing ever does. The authorities hold press conferences where Brian makes it known that he is eager to pay it and get his daughter back, but still, they hear nothing. It becomes clear that this likely wasn't the motive behind the abduction. The Lioness house is searched meticulously for clues, but Mr. Krull had left nothing behind, as always. He covered his tracks in their entirety. There was just nothing to be found. This was a man who knew what he was doing, who planned every moment of his crimes. Investigators became sure that he'd been watching the house for days, maybe even weeks before the abduction, making sure he knew the family's movements and routines. When he entered the house that night, he knew that Brian and Rosemary weren't there. Investigators asked everyone on the street if they'd noticed anything, anyone skulking around the area in recent weeks, but nobody had seen a thing. And then 50 hours later, Nicola just reappears. And this happened to be her 14th birthday. She was found in the nearby suburb of Kew near the electrical substation, and she was fully dressed and wrapped in a blanket. And once she was sure that her abductor had driven away, she removes her blindfold and makes her way to a nearby house to call for help. He'd given her instructions on what to do. "I will drop you off at a place and a change of clothes, and you will have to wait 10 minutes and then you can walk to a police station. I'll give you directions to the police station." He even warned her that the police would ask her lots of questions. And it was shortly after 2 a.m. when Brian received the call, his daughter's voice on the other end. Nicola was of great help to the police. Despite the trauma she'd been going through, she'd been able to make note of many details about the offender and the home she was kept in. Despite being blindfolded throughout the whole ordeal, she managed to sneak a few glances here and there, despite the fact that doing so may have put her life at risk. He'd told her, "If you try to see, it'll be very dangerous for you." He also told her that his freedom was worth more than her life, and he'd previously told Sharon something very similar. And just like Sharon as well, Nicola had also been bathed and cleaned meticulously before her release. Nicola recalled that as she walked blindfolded from the car to the house, her abductor wasn't too much taller than her. She guessed that he was around 5'8", and at one point she caught a glimpse of reddish brown hair. She even managed to get a glimpse of the bedroom and the bathroom that she was kept in, both of which were described as clean and well maintained. The bedroom had peach-coloured full-length curtains, a double bed with a peach-coloured headrest, an orange lamp with a yellow-slash-white striped shade, there was a bedside table and a dark-coloured blanket over a unit in the corner of the room. There was also a camera on a tripod at the end of the bed that Nicola was kept on. Investigators believe that Mr. Krull made home movies of his crimes as a kind of trophy, home movies that he probably still has in his possession to this very day. The bathroom was simple, with a bath mat, a wall-mounted sink, a glass shower unit with a sliding door, and a separate bath. The toilet was in a separate room to the bath, and it was oddly low to the ground, Nicola remembers. She said that at one point she remembered Mr. Krull having a conversation with somebody else in the room as well, but she never heard anyone replying. The police explored the possibility that Mr. Krull had an accomplice, but it's likely that this was yet another red herring to confuse the investigation. Nicola also remembered hearing the sound of low-flying planes arriving and departing. She counted multiple of them throughout the ordeal, and Sharon had said something very similar, that the planes were really loud. Through this, investigators pieced together that Mr. Krull lived somewhere on the flight path of Tullamarine Airport, probably very close to the airport. Both Sharon and Nicola managed to remember an amazing amount of information about their journeys to the house. They were both able to recall that the drive was on the right-hand side of the flat or the house where they were kept, and Nicola said they had one step up from the driveway up into the house. Sharon described the bedroom she was kept in as being the second room from the front door on the right-hand side, and Nicola amazed detectives with the fact that she counted out the seconds as she travelled in the attacker's car. She was able to tell them roughly how far she travelled and in which direction. She could say how many steps she took once outside the car and into the house. The investigators thought that all this information surely meant that it wouldn't be long until they could capture Mr. Krull. They had so much to go on here. But there was very little in the way of forensics, and once again, all the clues would lead to a dead end. They had nothing. All they could do was hope and pray that there wouldn't be another attack before they could figure out what was going on. If the pattern continued, the next victim would be kept for even longer as Mr. Krull got braver. Sharon was kept for 18 hours, Nicola for 50. Would the next victim even escape alive? Mr. Krull goes quiet for almost a year. But on the 13th of April 1991, he carries out his most infamous crime. The Chan House on Serples Road in Templestowe, Victoria, which was another Melbourne suburb, consisted of John and Phyllis Chan, their oldest daughter, 13-year-old Carmen, and her two younger sisters, Carly and Karen. John and Phyllis had moved to Melbourne from Hong Kong 16 years earlier and had started an empire of restaurants in the city. On the night in question, they were at one of their popular Chinese restaurants, just 10 minutes away in Lower Plenty. Carmen was at home babysitting her younger sisters. And this wasn't just any normal home, it was an 18-room mansion on Templestowe's Golden Mile, where all the nicest houses were located. It was protected by a 2-metre fence and electric front gates, which makes the fact that Mr. Krull could get in unnoticed all that more baffling. On the night of the 13th of April, Carmen had read her sisters a bedtime story before watching a documentary together in her bedroom. Around 9 p.m, the two oldest girls head down to the kitchen to make a snack, only to find a man waiting for them in the hallway, wearing a green-grey tracksuit and a dark balaclava. He was holding a long carving knife and grabbed the girls by their hair, ordering them back into Carmen's bedroom. He told them he didn't want to hurt them, ordering the two younger sisters into the cupboard and dragging a bed across the door to keep them in. After a while, when the man and Carmen were long gone, they managed to force the door open and called their father at the restaurant. The police once again knew that this wasn't a random attack. They made the connection to the previous abductions. Carmen was once again carefully selected. The abductor knew that there were no adults in the house that night, and he would have been watching carefully beforehand. According to a police report, there were no outward signs that children reside at this premises. No outside play equipment, no bicycles, etc. Yet somehow the intruder knew that children lived there. And in true Mr. Krull style, he had laid his red herrings. Before entering the home, he spray-painted the bonnet and the windscreen of family's Toyota Camry with the words, "Payback Asian Drug Dealer, More and More to Come." He knew the family were Asian before he even entered the house, and he was trying to paint it as some kind of racially motivated attack. Police dogs traced Carmen's scent through the kitchen sliding door, through the garden to a gate at the house's tennis court, across the court, through a second gate to a side fence, and off a drop of nearly 2 metres to the street. This was a big house, a big property, and Mr. Krull had planned his escape route perfectly. The trail went for another 3,000 metres to an overgrown vacant block, where it's believed that the kidnapper had hidden his car. As with Mr. Krull's usual routine, the police waited for Carmen to randomly turn up somewhere nearby, late at night, as the other two had done. But the hours and the days went by, and she didn't appear. Days later, at a heartbreaking press conference, John and Phyllis pleaded for Carmen to come home, for the abductor to release her. They waited, and still nothing. There was always hope that she would eventually turn up, but she just didn't. This hope was sadly extinguished a year later, on April 9th, 1992. Carmen's decomposed remains were found by a dog walker at Edgar's Creek in Thomastown, who spotted a human skull in some landfill. Excavation was a painstaking process and little was left of the body, but eventually it was confirmed through DNA that it was indeed Carmen. Her cause of death was established to be 3 gunshot wounds in the head. She was shot execution style. They think she was killed not long after her abduction. Phyllis Chan gave the police the first clue as to why Carmen may have been killed. See, Carmen was a feisty girl. She likely wouldn't have gone without putting up a hell of a fight in the process. She wouldn't have just let her abductor get away with hurting her. She wasn't timid or shy. The assistant commissioner said, "We suspect that she was pretty feisty and confronted and put up a fight with this particular offender and may have actually identified him. We know that she was probably not a compliant type of victim in these matters. We know that Mr. Krull went to great lengths to ensure that he was never identified. He washed his victims thoroughly, he changed their clothes. He made sure they didn't see him and he told both Nicola and Sharon that his freedom was more important than their lives. The police have no doubts that he would have killed them had he known that they could identify him." It's also a big possibility that Carmen may have actually already known her murderer prior to this, that she would have been able to identify him not just in terms of his appearance, but by actual name. Carmen went to the same school as Nicola, the Presbyterian Ladies' College, and please focus on this angle for a while. Was Mr. Krull someone linked to the school? Was this not a coincidence? Once again, all the questions just had no answers. They sat in wait for Mr. Krull to attack again, but he just never did. At least not under this MO. He seemed to just disappear, and there could be many reasons for this. He may have died, he may have moved, or been jailed for other crimes. After 1991, there has never been another attack attributed to Mr. Krull. He could just be lying in wait, or he could have been able to stop for some reason, control his urges. Maybe killing Carmen was just one step too far for even him, so he stopped. There's every chance that he could still just be wandering the streets of Melbourne. It's believed that he took trophies, reminders of his victims, items that he stole from the children, and he also has his homemade tapes. The Special Task Force investigation into Mr. Krull was called Operation Spectrum, consisting of 40 investigators working on the case full time. They followed 10,000 tip-offs, searched 30,000 houses in the vicinity of the airport, and arrested 73 people, mostly for sex offences unrelated but discovered during Operation Spectrum. 27,000 people were interviewed by Spectrum as part of the first investigation, and many people think the police did actually interview the offender, and that could be why he hasn't offended again. Maybe he thought the police were on his tail. Police even wrote to the state's 10,000 doctors and pleaded with them to breach doctor-patient confidentiality. They believe that Carmen may have injured her abductor in some way and that he may have sought medical help afterwards. Police travelled across all of Australia and even conducted interviews in Britain and the US. Detectives worked 25,000 hours of unpaid overtime. In 1991, the FBI contacted the Victoria Police with help in the case of Mr. Krull. This was very soon after the abduction of Carmen Chan, and they hoped that their profile could help lead to her safe recovery. The FBI recommended that the Victorian Police hold off on releasing this information they provided until the Monday, as they didn't want to induce any additional stress on the offender and jeopardise Carmen's safety. But they said that if she hadn't been released by the Monday, then it was recommended that a more proactive approach be undertaken. The FBI wrote in a letter to the Victoria Police, "This approach will utilise the media to communicate with citizens who are close to the offender with the hope that they recognise the characteristics and traits which describe the offender, become suspicious and come forward. It is recommended that a single telephone hotline be established and a trap and trace be installed on that line." Basically, the FBI were hoping that on the back of their profile, once it had been published in the media, that people recognise these characteristics in people they know and call the police. The FBI's profile of Mr. Krull included the following points. One is that they believe the offender may reside in the vicinity of the first assault, strengthened by the fact that the offender has returned to the same general area in his fourth assault. This area was the Lower Plenty area, and Carmen's house was just 10 minutes from here. Second is that all the assaults occurred during school holidays, and coupled with the offender's use of school uniform in the third assault, it suggested that there's a high degree of probability that the offender is involved with a school, potentially employed by a school. The offender also has an intense interest in children, especially children in the tween to young teenage age range. He will spend a great deal of time with these children in what appears to be a selfless dedication to the students. The apparent dedication may well have earned him recognition and awards such as Teacher of the Year or Coach of the Year. These type of awards may make the offender appear above suspicion to those who know him. The letter from the FBI writes verbatim, "It is imperative that the material to be released publicly focuses on dispelling the myth of the monster."
McCrispy strips are now at McDonald's. Tender, juicy, and its own sauce. Would you look at that? Well, you can't see it, but trust me, it looks delicious. New McCrispy strips, now at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Citizens have a misconception regarding child molesters in general, believing them to be stereotype monsters, men with raincoats, disheveled appearance, etc. In reality, this, of course, is not the case. The public need to be educated as to the true characteristics and appearance of the offender. Those who know the offender at this time believe him to be a nice guy, one who is genuinely interested in and dedicated to helping children and therefore is above suspicion. The next point is that he will have his own homemade pornography, as well as commercial pornography. He will have photographed and or videotaped his sexual assaults on the victims. The items will have great personal significance and he will not destroy them unless he believes authorities know they exist. The FBI recommended that no mention of these tapes should be made publicly. He is believed to be a functional individual. He has steady employment, is generally regarded as a good neighbour, polite, quiet and introverted. He would likely live in a single family residence with a garage or a carport. He may or may not live with somebody, and if he does, this person was absent during the time of the offences. If he is involved in a relationship, the partner would likely be aware of sexual dysfunctions on part of the offender. Possibly he's into role play based around school scenarios. Those who know the offender would notice a change in behaviour after each of these incidents. He would likely miss work or be preoccupied or have an inability to focus. In the offender's mind, there is likely no intent to harm the children. The incidents are purely sexually motivated on his behalf. Of course, this was written before Carmen had been found dead, of course, and like the offender said, his freedom was more important than her life. The offender will likely read all of the articles about himself and will, in all probability, attempt to change or control all mentioned behaviours. He will not be able to change the past though, will have exhibited these behavioural patterns previously. No matter how much he's tried to change, he's already been like this. His attempt to control his behaviour will result in him appearing more rigid and over-controlled. Regardless of the ultimate fate of the victim, the offender will experience a great deal of stress which he will not be able to control. So they're basically asking for the public to look out for somebody who's changing their behaviour, who looks very stressed, who is preoccupied, and just a little bit weird. His physical appearance is thought to be something similar to the following. A man aged between 35 and late 40s, slight build with sandy or ginger hair, clean shaven, softly spoken, and according to police, quite caring in his own monstrous way. He would often use words such as bozo, worrywart, and missy. Nowadays, he would be close to his 70s. All in all, he was a man with very few distinguishing features, just a very normal man in all respects. A $300,000 reward for any information leading to his conviction was offered. Despite all of this information and many, many leads, the investigation had nothing, and eventually would close in 1994 after spending $4 million. No one was identified as Mr. Krull. The closing of the task force was partially due to claims of corruption in the Victoria Police in the early 90s and very sloppy police work. For example, when the task force arrived on the scene of the Chan home within hours of Carmen's abduction, they found that the crime scene had not been preserved by the police as it should have been. The command post had been set up inside the house, there were people walking everywhere with no protective gear. Evidence that may have helped identify Mr. Krull may have been destroyed in those first few hours, but we'll never know because the police didn't do it properly. It's not thought that the attack in Lower Plenty with the unnamed first victim was the first attack either. It's believed that Mr. Krull was almost certainly responsible for an earlier series of attack in the southern suburbs of Melbourne in the early to mid 1980s. They were very similar, but not quite the same. The task force naturally wanted to review all of the evidence from these earlier cases, but a good amount of the evidence had been lost, including a piece of tape that Mr. Krull used to bind one of his victims. Since the early 1980s, there's obviously been a huge leap in forensic technology, and it's likely that he wasn't as careful in these early attacks as he was in the later ones. There may well have been extractable DNA on that piece of tape, but we'll never know because they lost it. Old records were missing as well, which also hindered Operation Spectrum. They spent a huge amount of their time just trying to recover old records and evidence instead of just searching for the offender. But in 2010, the task force was reopened under the name Operation Apollo. They said that it's going to stay active as long as it needs to until Mr. Krull has been apprehended. They were hoping that with the improvement of technology, forensic technology in particular, they could finally solve the case. And they do have a number of suspects in this case now, 7 in fact, who they've called the standout suspects. As you've probably already gathered, investigators in the early days were pretty convinced the offender was involved in the school system. All the attacks happened in school holidays and he had a particular interest in children. But there is also the possibility that he may have been involved in law enforcement. This is someone who had a deep understanding of forensics before forensic science was really a thing. He knew exactly how to cover his steps, he knew how the police would approach the investigation, so he threw in red herrings when he could to throw them off. Operation Apollo spent 6 months reviewing hundreds of thousands of pages of evidence gathered by Spectrum and transferring them all into an electronic format. 12,000 pieces of evidence were re-examined and several suspects were interviewed once again. Back in 1994, a dossier was created with the help of the FBI. This was given the name the Sierra Files, and it gave information of 7 suspects they believed to be Mr. Krull. So let's have a look at a few of the suspects here. The name that a lot of people automatically link with Mr. Krull is the Golden State Killer, who operated in California between 1974 to 1986. He was not one of the names included in the Sierra Files though. He was a serial killer, serial rapist and a burglar whose crimes just happened to end in California as the very similar crimes began in Australia. They shared many similarities in their style of attack, although the Golden State Killer didn't only target prepubescent girls. His victims ranged from 13 to 41. This was an angle that the US authorities did confirm as being looked at as a serious possibility, but it was eventually ruled out as being the same perpetrator, and as we know, in 2018, the Golden State Killer was identified in the form of Joseph DeAngelo, and it's been confirmed for sure that he cannot have been Mr. Krull. Another suspect was a man who was known to be a violent serial sex offender. His ex-partner had come forward to the police with his exploits in 2011, and they were told that this man had homemade pornography, he had access to a house near the airport but lived permanently in the eastern suburbs, and he was known to sexually abuse girls. Everything fitted with the FBI analysis of the offender, and his former partner painted him as a sadistic predator who abused her for decades. Apparently, he spoke often about Carmen during sex, and he was very nervous when stories about her featured on the news. He was very upset when the killer was dubbed as Mr. Krull, apparently. The partner also said this man commented about another cold case often, a still unsolved cold case, implying that he knew the culprit or helped bury the body. We don't know the name of this case publicly. The police took these claims very seriously, but some of the information appeared contradictory or impossible to confirm. And whilst the property over the airport was indeed over the flight path, it didn't match the layout that Nicola and Sharon reported. There was another suspect detained in 2013 called Robert Keith Knight, a man who was a youth worker and a school volunteer. He'd been arrested twice already for a variety of crimes against children, and over the years a multitude of victims came forward accusing him of abuse. He was a suspect in the original Spectrum investigation, and they weren't ever able to rule him as in or out, he simply remained as a person of interest. He was first convicted and sent to jail for crimes against children in 1996. And within just a number of months after being released in 2009, he amassed a collection of child pornography and was arrested once again. He fitted many of the categories of Mr. Krull, but they still weren't satisfied that he was the offender they were looking for. He committed suicide in 2013 by jumping from an upper floor of his prison unit. He was said to be an incredibly cold man, like even the coldest of people would have some regrets about their behaviour, especially involving children. And this man showed absolutely none. Knight showed no emotion, he showed no remorse. The only reason he ever pleaded guilty was because the evidence against him was overwhelming. I'm about to detail the seven suspects included in the Sierra Files. Now, I don't know if these two men that I've just mentioned are involved in the Sierra Files or not. They were actually released to the Herald Sun by the Victoria Police, but the Herald Sun declined to post the names, just basic information about these potential suspects, I'm sure for legal reasons. So these seven names may include Robert Knight or may not do, I'm not too sure. So the first suspect in the Sierra Files is a now 70-year-old man who lived in Eltham at the time of the attacks. He ran a number of businesses in the area before moving to a caravan park in Lake Cathy, New South Wales, after marrying a Canadian woman. In June 2014, he moved to Canada with his wife. Number two is a 62-year-old man who lived in Musk at the time of the attacks. He changed his name by deed poll in 1988 for some reason and has since changed it again. Number three is a 61-year-old man who lived in Harcourt, a while outside of the city. He still owns a house in Harcourt but spends most of his time in Melbourne. The next suspect actually died in 2015 at the age of 66 and lived in Knoxfield at the time of the attacks. He was married with children and grandchildren and worked as a self-employed tradesman. A 65-year-old man lived in Bulwyn at the time of the attacks in a home that was later demolished and replaced with a two-story mansion. This man is aware that he is a suspect but has denied any involvement, saying to the Herald Sun, "I've never had any charges laid against me. I've been interviewed, yes, along with 27,000 other people. I was interviewed. That was it." The next suspect will be 71 today if he's still alive. He lived in Glen Iris at the time of the attacks and there was no answer when the Herald Sun knocked at his door. Neighbours aren't even aware of his existence and his name doesn't exist on the electoral roll or on social media, so this guy is a bit of a ghost. But there is a prime suspect in the form of former Melbourne University lecturer Brian Elkner. He's now in his late 70s and is a convicted sex offender, having attacked six women and young girls. Like the Mr. Krull attacks, they took place in the victims' homes and they were threatened with a knife. In October 1974, he was convicted and sentenced to 10 years in prison and was released shortly before the first Mr. Krull attack. Brian is aware that he's a prime suspect but denies the accusation, saying his crimes were in the past and he's turned his life around. Investigators are still working on the case of Mr. Krull. They have little in terms of forensics to investigate. He was meticulously detailed. This is a man who really knew what he was doing. As far as we're aware, the public, there's no DNA to test, but you never know if investigators are holding something back. In 2016, a $1 million reward was announced for any information leading to the capture of Mr. Krull, a huge jump up from the previous $300,000. But if this case does get solved at this point, it's going to be through the offender. If they're still alive or free, maybe they slip up or someone close to them comes forward with new information. Someone somewhere out there must hear the description of Mr. Krull and think that it reminds them of someone they knew or know. Investigators on this case now are saying the way this is going to get solved is through loose lips of the offender or someone who has harbored knowledge for some reason is triggered into passing information onto the police. That's the only way this is going to get solved at this point. Someone somewhere out there must know something. And even if it's small, the investigators are looking into every single possibility. The police really are willing to look into any and all leads at this point. For example, maybe you moved into a house near Tullamore Airport with a layout similar to what was described by the girls. My skin crawls at the thought of somebody like this still walking around a free man. Maybe he moved somewhere else and changed his MO enough to not ever be linked. Maybe there are many, many more victims of Mr. Krull out there. Thank you so much for watching this video. If you live in Melbourne and you potentially know anything at all, I know it's a long shot, but if you know anything or know somebody who might know something, then the police are really begging for anyone to come forward. Literally anything could lead them to the answer at this point. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of Mysteries and Histories. If you have a bit of time, I would love for you to go and leave a review wherever you're listening to this podcast and spread the word. It would be much appreciated. I'll see you next week.